I'm Dave DeWitt. This is Tested from WUNC, a look at what the day's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, on the decline, but far from the finish line. The virus doesn't care who you blame. As clusters on college campuses grow, more universities have had to shift to all online classes. Professors, students, staff, and some media outlets are blaming administrators. Administrators and lawmakers are blaming students. And students are blaming administrators, and in some cases, other students. Guess what? The virus doesn't care who you blame. It just keeps infecting people. Old, young, middle-aged, doesn't matter. There are things we can do to slow it down, but not enough of us are doing it. Or maybe, finally, we are. Because despite the campus clusters, the state of North Carolina as a whole is experiencing decline in some of its key metrics. The number of hospitalizations and COVID-related deaths is trending slightly downward. Meanwhile, the state's positive test result this past Monday was 7%. State health officials have long said the number should be 5% or lower. The numbers are not overly positive, but I've been accused by some people in my life of being a tad pessimistic. So I asked Rose Hoban, the editor of North Carolina Health News, what she thinks.
I'm a little more optimistic than you sound, Dave. You know, because the numbers are creeping down. I mean, look, things aren't going to turn on a dime. I keep telling people we're still living with the decisions and actions that people made a month or so ago, right? Because it takes so long for this all to play out. So what we are starting to see is that perhaps the mask mandate's taking hold and that people are starting to embrace it. So for what, 13, 14 days out of the last 20, the positivity rate had been in the 6% range. Now, over the past few days, they've crept back up to 7% range. And I bet it's largely because of all the testing being done on college campuses and the spread that's taking place in that context. I mean, last time I looked, there was a total of more than 1,000 positive tests just on college campuses, right?
Right.
I just hope that state health officials take the opportunity to hammer home that these efforts are paying off. You know, so but we've had like 3 days of hospitalizations below 1,000. You know, it's just it's creeping downward. And the trick is that once those numbers continue to creep downward and if they get to that 5% benchmark, then people just have to keep the efforts up. You know, we've seen in other countries and other states that people get complacent with lower numbers and then they let up their guard and then, whoops, you have an outbreak.
So you and your publication, North Carolina Health News, have throughout the pandemic really highlighted the particular risks and challenges facing rural hospitals. So as this pandemic enters yet another month, how are they faring?
You know, COVID's been pretty hard on North Carolina's rural hospitals. We did some looking around at hospital financials and found that across the board, like hospitals just did poorly during those months when elective surgeries were restricted. And, you know, there was a lot of intensive care primarily for COVID patients. And, you know, the regular office visits and tests and procedures that generate revenue for hospitals were on hold. So yeah, I'll give you an example here. Cone Health in Greensboro had done well in the first quarter, but they only just about broke even in the second quarter up to the end of June with less than 1% margin, which is the excess revenue over expenses. So, you know, in comparison, Cone had 2.9% margin last year. So I start with them because they're a good barometer of hospital health. They're not like a behemoth like Duke, but they're not small fry either. And, you know, they took a hit. So in contrast, rural hospitals are always operating on a much thinner margin. So we looked at the financials for Vidant, which is the largest system in eastern North Carolina. They have a catchment area of like more than 25 counties, and they lost money even after laying people off in March. Think about that. In the middle of the pandemic, they were having to let people go. This is a really important system for in that part of the state for many places in eastern North Carolina. They're the only game in town. We spoke to someone from the National Rural Health Association who noted that what they've seen is that hospitals that have like 3 bad years in a row are the ones that go under. And that's more likely to happen in states like North Carolina that didn't expand Medicaid. The quote from NRHA's vice president, Brock Slayback, was that, quote, you can generally roll things along for a bit and keep things going and keep a hospital operating, and then all of a sudden one day it's just impossible.
So looking ahead a little bit, a lot of people staking their faith on a vaccine. What do we know about large-scale clinical trials, and if any are taking place here in the Triangle?
Well, there's a lot of activity around the country on vaccine trials, mm-hmm. so, you know, we're no exception. Pfizer's running a vaccine trial with sites across the state. That's for a two-dose vaccine that's given 3 weeks apart. They're looking to enroll about 30,000 people. You know, and you might get the placebo instead of the vaccine. So, and that Pfizer trial, I took a look at the clinical trial database that's on the NIH website. And, you know, they've got multiple arms of the study that they're looking to do, you know, dosage, efficacy. Like, so they're doing a lot. Moderna, that's that company that's gotten a bunch of high-level publicity about its vaccine. It's an mRNA vaccine. They're also recruiting people around the state and around the country. One of the sites is in Raleigh, another's in Chapel Hill. They haven't started recruiting in Chapel Hill yet. They're looking for people at high risk. So you can't just be like an average Joe to be accepted into that trial. You know, you need to be someone who's at some risk. So say a healthcare worker or someone who works in a meat processing plant or these days a college student. I spoke last week to Sam Taylor, who's the head of the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, and he made the point that right now, North Carolina is deeper into the vaccine manufacturing game than research on a COVID vaccine. Taylor told me that we're number two in drug manufacturing in the country by value. I guess that's, you know, by revenue. And only California produces more drugs by value than North Carolina. He also told me that right now Seqirus, which has a manufacturing facility out in Holly Springs, they're going, as he said, full bore on the flu vaccine because, you know, that's right around the corner.
Rose Hoban is the editor of North Carolina Health News. Hang tight, more in a moment.
I'm Anita Rao, a host at WUNC. A lot of my job is asking difficult questions and digging deeper for the answers, even when it gets uncomfortable. It's the trust and understanding that's built when a conversation gets into awkward territory that drives my new podcast, Embodied. It's impolite conversations, intimate connections, and important discoveries in every episode. Listen and subscribe today on your favorite audio app.
The first sign that something was amiss was when the pop-up tent showed up. It was blue, about 10 feet by 10 feet, and it was planted in the middle of a grassy circle in the middle of the cul-de-sac I live on. Then came the SUVs and hybrids and other vehicles, carrying dads, moms, kids, and grandparents. Suddenly, a party of about 30 people had started on a Friday evening. No masks, no social distancing, during a pandemic. The next day, Saturday morning, same hosts, different group. Another party of about 30 people, there to celebrate a child's birthday. I'm a non-confrontational person. As a reporter, I've asked uncomfortable and probing questions of presidential candidates, governors, senators, chancellors, billionaires, and other powerful people. But I'm loath to ask another citizen to wear a mask in a grocery store, even though Governor Roy Cooper seems to indicate I would be right to do so.
For those who continue to defy basic decency and common sense because they refuse to wear a mask, either wear one or don't go in the store. The refusal to wear a mask is selfish. It infringes on the life and liberty of everyone else in the store.
We're all forced to make ethical choices now that we never really dreamed of. For me, the decision to wear a mask and social distance is a pretty easy one. But confronting a neighbor about a party a few yards from my house, I hesitated and stewed. And then, in a move that could be enshrined in the passive-aggressive Hall of Fame, I mowed my lawn instead, lingering near the front edge of my yard and letting the loud motor linger as a grandmother and several young children played together in a kid's water table a few feet away. Needless to say, the lawnmower did nothing to deter the partygoers.
I am wishing that we had some sort of nonverbal communication that can say, I'm uncomfortable, could you please wear your mask? In a way that wouldn't be antagonistic, but just want to let you know. And I haven't seen it yet. I looked up the American Sign Language for mask, and it's not quite right because it's also the American Sign Language for raccoon. And so it's a mask for the eyes, not the mouth.
Associate Professor Jim Thomas is an epidemiologist and a fellow at the Parr Center for Ethics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
I deal a lot with this question of trust, and it can trust be established and maintained? And if it can, there are some pretty important things that we can do, some difficult things that we can do, but without that trust, most everything falls apart.
Thomas spoke with our producer, Charlie Shelton Ormond, about ethics during the pandemic and how we should navigate social situations that challenge our comfort or safety.
So if we experience some sort of dissonance with some social behavior that we witness, for example, you see a party happening without anybody wearing a mask in your neighbor's backyard, what do you do in that situation? You know, do I confront them? Do I call someone and report them? What would be your advice for how to ethically approach a social situation like that?
So let me start first with what public health ethics would say. When public health is talking about enforcement of measures within an epidemic, they talk about working within the legal system and the authorities that have the power to enforce. Now, I think that they may be, they're trying to avoid any kind of vigilantism of enforcement, but that is more easily done when the rates are lower. When you have high rates and you have lots of people who are not complying, that becomes a really difficult task, and it begins to look more like a social phenomenon where neighbor corrects neighbor. But still, we're going to be encountering people who are not wearing their masks or who are gathering in crowds, and what do you do? That's your question. So the next thought I have is that if there is a crowd of people who are not wearing masks, that's the last place that I want to walk into,
right,
to challenge somebody. Because, you know, you're going to get exposed even if you walk over there with a mask.
Right.
If you know the person, if it's a neighbor that you know, then you could call them. And, of course, it's going to depend on the kind of relationship you have with them. Plus, you're likely to encounter some pretty strong resistance. They're not wearing masks for reasons that are pretty well set in their psyches already, and maybe even their political outlooks. And they may view your approaching them as a confrontation and an opportunity to stand their ground.
So who should be doing this policing, or quote, policing this public health behavior? You know, who do you think that ethically falls to? If not a neighbor, then who should step in there?
Well, you know, it's interesting that we're having this conversation right on the heels of, or maybe even in the midst of, the defund the police, where the conversation there is that we have overloaded the agenda of the police to do too many things. And so now we're saying we're in a situation and we want to add something to what the police do. We want them to chase down these parties and tell them to put on their masks. So I wonder, you know, we've got contact tracers, and I'm just sort of idly musing, but I wonder if we could have some people whose job it is to help enforce things or to work with bar owners and restaurant owners to coach them on steps they can take, on signage, on ways to encourage and perhaps even enforce masks. If we could have a group of people deputized to serve in that purpose.
So we talked about the mask becoming this polarizing thing, whether you wear a mask or not wear a mask, that's issuing some sort of statement one way or the other. And I'm wondering how this division compares to other public health dilemmas in the past. Have our ethical standards been challenged and divided in this way with other public health dilemmas?
So there were disagreements in the last major pandemic we had in 1918, in pandemic flu. There were people who objected to wearing masks. But in what I know of that history, I haven't seen the resistance that runs to the very top of the nation, the active resistance of our president to measures that would help control the disease. And it trickles down to governors and mayors, the leadership of the response has been highly politicized. Now, public health ethics would say that's one of the worst things you could do, but ethics doesn't have much teeth. It can say that's wrong, and it can shake a finger at it, but it doesn't have the power to enforce it and make it happen unless it's put into law. And even then, if the president chooses to neglect a law or a regulation, he or she can do that. So it makes ethics look or feel kind of impotent. And I think we are in a moment where there is a greater challenge to that than what we have seen in the past.
Associate Professor Jim Thomas is an epidemiologist and a fellow at the Parr Center for Ethics at UNC Chapel Hill. That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Dave DeWitt. Charlie Shelton-Ormond is our producer. Lindsay Foster-Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.